The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Evelyn Starr, author of Teenage Waste Brand, How Your Brand Can Stop Struggling and Start Scaling, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Evelyn Starr to talk about her book, Teenage Waste Brand, How Your Brand Can Stop Struggling and Start Scaling. Evelyn Starr is a brand expert and writer with over 25 years of marketing strategy and research experience. She specializes in working with brands in adolescence, which means brands that have stalled after their initial success. Before founding her consultancy in 1999, Evelyn worked for some of New England's most recognized brands, including Dunkin' Donuts, Verifine Products, and the First Years. Evelyn earned an MBA in marketing from Boston College's Carroll School of Management, go Eagles, and graduated with honors from Vassar College, go Brewers, with a BA in economics and French. And interesting fact, her father was the Beatles drummer Ringo Starr. Evelyn, congratulations on Teenage Waste Brand and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, Evelyn, thanks to you. For the last week, while I've been reading your book, this song has been stuck in my head.
Teenage Wasteland. It's only Teenage Wasteland. Teenage Wasteland. Oh, yeah. Teenage Wasteland. They're all wasted.
So I hope that now I've put that earworm in every listener's ear, and it'll now leave mine, because that song has just been going through my head. I've got to ask, was your father, Ringo, upset that your book title brought to mind a song from The Who rather than The Beatles?
You know, he wasn't that upset. He wasn't that upset. He understood. He's a pretty understanding guy.
Oh, yeah. And you know what else? Because Evelyn Starr, I do a lot of research for these interviews. I mean, I read the book, of course, but then there's lots of deep Wikipedia rabbit holes that I go down. And one of them is that The Who's original drummer, Keith Moon, was a very close friend of Ringo, of your dad, Ringo Starr. So anyway, what's also a little bit of a Marketing Book Podcast inside story here. We had to reschedule this interview from the day I normally interview authors because you're helping your parents get into their summer home later this week. Now, I know that he and your mother, Barbara Bach, live in Beverly Hills. Is their summer home like in Malibu or something?
No, it's a little more humble than that. It's Gunquit, Gunquit, Maine.
Oh, but, oh, interesting. Wow. That's clever. And now that's going to be the next hot place. So
sure.
Now, just so everybody knows, I think her dad is Ringo Starr, but I'm not sure. And the real interesting fact about Evelyn Starr is that in high school, Her class, her senior class, voted her female class bookworm. Wow. And I guess my question was, did you end up marrying the male class bookworm?
I did not. And I did not know they were going to vote me into that title until I heard I had won it.
Oh, so you didn't really run for that.
No, this was not a competition. This was just one of those, you know, you get awards for a zillion different things senior year. And this is the one my class decided to confer on me. So
yes,
my geek credentials run really deep.
Well, Evelyn, if you were female class bookworm, this is your podcast and these are your people. Because I think there's a lot of people that are like-minded like that. And I can remember in my senior class, of course, this was all unofficial, but they had all these funny classifications. And I remember one of them, which I did not win, was most likely to get forced into marriage early. I mean, they were just vicious. So anyway, there you go. Well, anyway, you sent me the nicest 2-page handwritten letter with your book, which I really appreciate. And it was all written in purple ink. And Evelyn Starr, don't think I don't notice these things. I know that's sort of your color, but that was actually not the first thing that I'd gotten from you. I gave a talk about a year ago to, it's SAMI in Boston, Sales and Marketing
Innovators.
From Louis Kadima, who is the president. He may still be in charge. He may be president for life. He's one of those kind of guys. He's the author of Bullseye Marketing. I believe he's working on his second edition. And he invited me to give a talk. And you were listening in on the webinar. I got a thank you note from you. I think that's the only thank you note I've ever gotten for doing a webinar. So it made an impression on me. And I appreciate that. So don't go changing, Evelyn.
I won't. Thank you.
Now, I want to read a couple things from the beginning of the book. You write on page 4, this book is the result of what I've learned over 9 years of studying brands, the way they develop and why many of them get stuck after an initial burst of success. And you go on to write, if your brand has stalled or plateaued after a good initial run, you're not alone. I've encountered many founders who launched businesses in the 1990s and 2000s who have hit a similar wall. Owners who knew their brands were capable of more and could envision that growth, but did not know how to scale the wall and get past it. Brands experience growing pains akin to human adolescence and often exhibit similar symptoms. In this book, I'm going to show you what these symptoms look like. I'll help you diagnose your brand and then provide you with the path that can help you address the problem and get back to growth. I'm not trying to be cute or to play brand psychologist. Rather, I prefer straight talk to marketing jargon and have found the lens of adolescence helpful in understanding the hurdles brands face and how to address them. As you read this book, you'll be able to see your brand's issues from a new perspective, one that is easy to relate to. If you've parented a teenager, you've already seen some of these symptoms in action. And just in time for a book that has, you know, the topic of adolescent brands, my voice seems to be changing. So I may be going through adolescence. I seem to have had a sore throat this morning, and I feel great, but it just sounds a little off. So for people who are listening for the first time, I don't always sound this way. I try to sound a little better. But Evelyn, let's talk about the elephant in the room here. I want to talk about the B word, and I'm talking about brand, okay? Mm-hmm. It's really misunderstood by a lot of people, and I think it's misused by certain practitioners out there, and you write in the beginning of the book that it's important to have a productive discussion about the brand. We first need to have a common view of what it is. And you write, as a business owner, you might think of brands as images or entities that marketing creates, a logo you paid a designer for, a clever tagline, an ad campaign. But that's not what a brand is or how it is formed. And I'd like to add that there was a book on the show a while back called Unbranding by Allison and Scott Stratton. Excellent book. It had 100 short chapters. And the first chapter was titled, It's Not About Your Logo. So, Evelyn Starr, a brand, what the heck is it? Let's set people straight.
So, a brand is, in the eye of your beholder and in the eye of your audience, the sum of all the experiences and impressions they've had with the entity. And they accumulate that over time. So brands are dynamic that way, but it's a sum of all the experiences. And to show you how that works, Doug, I'd like to tell you a quick story about my kitchen backsplash, actually. So a few years ago, we were looking to have tile put up on the wall in our kitchen, and no one we knew could recommend a great tiler. So I went to two tile retail stores, grabbed two lists, and started dialing for tilers. And, you know, a good craftsperson is worth their weight in gold, but it's really hard to get their attention, you know, especially during the pandemic when everybody decides great time for home improvement. So I tried to contact seven tilers with the hope of coming out with one good one. The first two I contacted responded within a couple of hours, and the third one responded the next morning, and they all set up times to come and see our project within the next 2 days. The fourth one said, I'll get back to you in a couple of weeks. The fifth one sent me a forward email saying, could you ping me next week? And the sixth one said, just send me a picture of your project and I'll bid on it. And the seventh one didn't respond at all. So the first three got classified in my mind as responsive and interested in my project. And the latter four got classified as less responsive, not interested, not available. And I just shelved them. And then
it was probably a preview of what it was going to be like if you did hire them.
Exactly. Exactly. And so as the three came in, you know, I got further impressions. The first guy was very straightforward, very transparent about his bid and just bid for the labor. The second guy came in and said, well, I'm waiting on materials for a project for a friend of Bob Kraft. And for listeners who might not know, Bob Kraft is the owner of the New England Patriots. He said, but I might be able to fit you in between.
Does that carry a lot of street cred in the New England area, Evelyn?
Maybe, but not with me. I'm not originally from New England, so we don't have to get into my sports preferences just yet.
Okay.
But we can go there if you'd like. And then the third was this friendly couple who came in and gave me extremely detailed ideas about all the different things they could do with my tiles. So then those three, in my mind, became Mr. Straightforward, Mr. Name Dropper, and the friendly couple with the great ideas, right? And so you could see layering on all of them being, of course, responsive and interested in my project. This is how their brands were forming in my mind. And this is how customers form brands from their first experience, everything they hear about it, reviews they read, everything layers on. So brands are the sum of your experiences and impressions of an entity.
Yes. Let me just quote from page 10 in your book. A brand is the expectation of what you will get when you interact with an entity based on prior experiences with and impressions of that entity. And you go on to write, note that the consumer or receiving party is doing the branding. And that's so important. And there have been enough books about branding that I've received over the years by folks, you know, asking to be on the show. And the flaw that I've seen in, I don't know, enough that I've noticed is that the presumption is that it's something that comes from the marketing department. It's something you say about yourself rather than what I just described there. And let's go on, because you mentioned in your book, and it's endorsed by the king of the marketing book podcast, Mark Schaefer. And if anyone ever meets him, he does like to be called Your Highness. Okay. So, but it's actually a more of an Elvis thing, not a, you know, British UK, you know, royalty thing. But you talk about his book, Marketing Rebellion, which is on the podcast, and we'll include a link to that interview on your episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. But he, in his book, which you mentioned, he talked about this McKinsey study. And this was a McKinsey study from 2009, okay? That was a while ago. And I'm quoting from your book, it revealed that two-thirds of touch points during the active evaluation phase of a purchase come from consumer-driven marketing activities like reviews, word of mouth, recommendations from friends, family, and social media connections, in-store interactions, and recollections of past experiences. Even the one-third of touch points that come from company-driven marketing gets filtered through the customer's lens, whether they found it believable, whether they liked it, whether it offended them. you know, it's hard to know, but the point is that most of what is being said about your brand is not being said by companies out there. And I think that's really, really important. So can you talk about what causes brand adolescence?
So brand adolescence comes into play when what is being said about the brand doesn't jive with people's experience. That's at the high level of it. And it can manifest itself in lots of different ways. So for example, for a company where the founder has been there from the beginning, the day one, nobody's had any experience with the brand, you get your shot to say, this is what our brand is. But over time, as people experience it, they form their own idea of what the brand is, and it lives in your audience's mind. And over a period of years, the gap between what you're saying, if you haven't changed your message or kept pace with what your audience thinks, and what they experience or think about your brand grows. It's a widening gap. And at some point, things get disconnected, and that's when the brand stalls and you have brand adolescence. So more specifically, it could be when your messages don't resonate with your audience, or where you tell them the customer experience that they're going to have and they don't receive that experience, or they have a different one. Or even from an employee point of view, because of course marketing reflects on the brand from a attracting employee point of view as well. So the experience your recruiters tell prospects that they might have when they join the company, if it differs from what they actually experience inside the company, that's a gap too. And that's a problem.
Yes. And what's great is that prospective employees, customers, anyone can read things like Glassdoor or other things to find out. I mean, you just can't control it. It has more to do with your behavior now than what you say. Mm. So there are eight of these examples of brand adolescence in the book, and we're not going to have time to go into all of them. But in looking at page 14, I was wondering if you could maybe walk us through at a very high level what they are, and then we'll dive into a few of them.
Sure. So the biggest one, the one I put first for that reason, is that brands can have an identity crisis. And when that happens, it's because the brand doesn't have a clear purpose and defined attributes that resonate with customers. So they have nothing guiding their marketing in a consistent basis. Brands can run with the wrong crowd by targeting an audience that's either too small to support the brand or includes one that does not value what the brand offers. Mm-hmm. Brands can be self-centered by putting management's interests before customers' needs and concerns. I'm looking at you, Facebook.
That's right.
Brands can try too hard to fit in or suffer from FOMO, which is fear of missing out, by chasing what other brands are doing instead of finding a niche they can own and standing for something specific. Brands can need to make new friends by maxing out their initial target audience or losing them for some reason. Brands can need to defend their position, and I call that needing to defend their varsity spot.
Yes.
By proving that a niche is viable and then having to fight off the onslaught of competitors that follows them into that spot. Mm-hmm. Brands can oversleep by ignoring industry developments and market trends. And they can assert their independence by growing to the point where their leader either no longer has the skill set or the interest in managing them to move forward.
I think I've worked at companies or worked serving customers in the agency world with companies that have experienced every single one of those. So I love the way you framed it. And let's go back to that first one and talk about identity crisis. But first, I want to play something and ask you to follow up on it.
Dear Mr. Vernon, we accept the fact that we had to sacrifice a whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay telling you who we think we are. And you see us as you want to see us. In the simplest terms, with the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain, and an athlete,
and a basket case, a princess,
and a criminal.
Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club.
So, Evelyn Starr, that letter was reprinted in your book from the 1985 movie, The Breakfast Club. Explain why that is there in the chapter on brands having an identity crisis.
Well, when I wrote the book, I really wanted it to be fun to read and easy to relate to. And The Breakfast Club, to me, is a movie that so many people can relate to because we all experience some point in our adolescence where somebody wanted to stereotype us, you know, where we were trying to fit in and people wanted to put us in a box and we don't want to be in that box. We are our own person. And so that seemed like a great way to introduce the concept of identity crisis.
My daughter, who was born in 1998, so she's 23, she loves that movie. I mean, I think it's not just people who were alive when it came out. It's definitely it takes us all back to high school. And the thing that really resonated with me was the guy that was in charge.
Don't mess with a bull, young man. You'll get the horns. Yeah. The next time I have to come in here, I'm cracking skulls. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
I'm sorry. You know, I loved that movie and I just, it made so much sense for the identity crisis. But can you tell us a little more depth? What are some of the signs that your brand has an identity crisis? And the reason I'm asking this is because I see these all the time.
Yeah. They're everywhere you look around. So if your customers, if you're having trouble understanding why your customers choose your brand over another, or you have trouble explaining to a prospect why they should choose your brand over another, that's a sign. If you feel like you're, every time you go to write an ad or do some sort of marketing, you're recreating the wheel. You're starting from scratch. That's a sign. If you don't know which new product offerings you should pursue and which ones you should ditch, that's a sign. All of these things are an indication that your brand hasn't codified its purpose and set down its attributes so that they have these guidelines for your marketing decision making.
Yes, and in the book you have examples of companies that were struggling from all of these. For those readers that maybe haven't suffered through some of these things, and so let's talk about the solution to some of this identity crisis and brand purpose. So, explain brand purpose and how that can help with the identity crisis. And again, the reason I'm asking you to explain this is because brand purpose, I think, might mean something different to everyone or most people that hear that those terms.
Yeah, that's true. And I've seen it used in a lot of different terms. And I'd also like to add that sometimes people call the purpose a vision or they call it a mission. I don't like when they use three different terms like that. I like to keep it simple. So a brand purpose is a short statement that describes what your brand wants to be. And it's the reason your company or your brand is in business or, you know, in a situation where there's an umbrella brand. It's the reason that that product or service line exists. What is the problem you are there to solve? And what are you doing to contribute to the world? So it becomes more tangible, I think, when we talk about some examples. Mm-hmm. And I want to point out, well, let me read these examples to you. So Life is Good, one of my favorite companies. Their purpose is to spread the power of optimism. Google, which touches pretty much everybody's life, their purpose is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. And then one more example for a company that's been in business over 100 years is L.L. Bean. Mm-hmm. Their purpose is to sell goods and services that allow people to get outside and enjoy the outdoors. Those are really clear, short statements that everybody in those organizations can hold in their mind and aim their efforts at, right? So everybody, the whole brand team, as big as they are, and Google's is huge, right? They're all working towards that end.
Yeah, and I would add that they're not so much about what they do or how they do it.
Right. They're not about what they do and how they do it. And you'll also notice that there are no specific products there. You know, a product-specific purpose is going to get you in trouble.
Yes.
And if you don't think a product-specific purpose is going to get you in trouble, talk to all the people making fax machines.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So, what can you talk a bit about how companies can go about starting to zero in on their brand purpose?
Yes. Brand purposes often come from the reason the founder started the company in the first place. It's very common that someone had a problem, searched for a solution, and couldn't find one, so they decided to create one themselves. So the founder's story is a great place to start looking for your purpose. And then beyond that, talking to your audience about why they come to your brand and what they get out of it can also be really helpful. If you've gotten fairly, you know, several years into your business and you haven't nailed your purpose, getting some input that way will give you some perspective.
Yes. And there's a section where you talk about determine the problem your brand solves, which forces people to think about the customer. But there was one interesting thing on there on the next page that talked about, that I really liked, and I've learned this by doing a lot of buyer persona research. And you write, one way to uncover this is to talk about the different situations that precede your customer calling. What happens to prompt them to call you? What change has occurred for them? And when I work with clients, that's something they struggle with. It's just not the first thing that they're thinking about. And when, you know, you go off and you do some research into your customer's life and so forth, one thing that clients have said that I found interesting is they'll say, wow, you know, I forgot about how much goes on in our customer's world before they come to us, which a little bit of empathy snuck in there. So that was really helpful. Well, okay, we talked about brand purpose. What is a brand attribute, which is a real important part of this?
A brand attribute is, you know, usually an adjective that people think of that in their minds that they relate to the brand. And so I talk about the brand having a personality. So a brand identity is composed of the purpose plus the attributes together. That is, you know, their reason for being and how they want to be perceived put together, which is, you know, in the world of adolescence, human adolescence, how Erik Erikson, the German-American developmental psychologist who identified identity crisis, that's his solution for teenagers is, you know, when you're grappling with how do I maintain my individual identity but still fit in with my peer group, he said, you have to decide who you want to be and how you want to be perceived. So the who you want to be is the purpose part. The attributes are a collection of adjectives that are unique to your brand that help guide you in the voice of your brand, the tone of your brand. And again, I like to use examples. And why not use you, Doug, as an example?
Uh-oh.
So your personal brand.
Those charges were dropped.
Okay. Those charges were dropped. Okay. Well, so noted. But I was thinking about you and looking on your artillery website, salesartillery.com. And what I noticed was when I think of you, I think of someone who is direct, someone who is funny, despite what your wife might say, and someone who is really well prepared. Those are the three adjectives that I would use to describe you that first come to mind. And I know that about you as a person, and then your company reflects those attributes as well. And so when you're describing how you approach your projects, you are using humor. You're being very direct. You tell people, you know, there's no BS here. And you clearly do a lot of preparation before you advise them. So that's how those attributes come into play in the brand identity and guide marketing and pretty much everything else the brand does.
Mm. And I'm also rather uncomfortable talking about myself. But seriously, that's interesting you say that. And to go back to the book, you talk about how, is in one part, where you should go to your customers and ask them or poll them, get a sense of what their perception is, and it'll very often surprise you what they say, right?
Yes, absolutely. That happened to me. I'm betting you know, the three adjectives I described, I'm not sure that those are the ones you would have come up with to describe your personal brand. Mm-hmm. So it's really important because, again, brands form in the minds of your audience, right? They're not yours to control. They're like children. You can influence them. You can't control them. Mm-hmm. So you really need to know. You need to ask people how you're being perceived and how your brand is being received.
Interesting. Well, let's move on to another one. And Evelyn Starr, enough about me. What do you think of me? No, I'm kidding. Don't answer that question. I want to talk about the part on acting self-centered now that you've, you know, completely flustered me here. But I think this is the identity crisis, acting self-centered. Oh, I just see it, I think, almost every day. It's a problem. It's a human problem. I mean, humans are very self-oriented, which has helped us to evolve over the many, many years. But talk about the attributes that indicate your brand might really be self-centered. I mean, what are some of those symptoms that you see for a really self-centered brand?
So if your brand team is often talking about how customers are wrong, and you get many of those complaints, then, you know, that should raise a flag. If you are trying to suppress negative reviews or argue about them, that is also a sign that something may be going on. Really, the signs about this are really when the company is more concerned with propelling itself than it is about serving their audience.
Yes.
That's the issue.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that contribute to this? I found that very interesting. I mean, there are certain things that actually propel companies more towards self-centeredness than they may realize, like the way they're rewarding people, for instance.
Yes, definitely the way they're rewarding people. So if your performance or reward system is set up so that you are gaining more followers and you're rewarding the people who are helping you do that, but you're not delivering much to your followers, there's a problem there.
Uh-huh.
Or if you're more concerned about how your product looks in terms of the vision that you have for it, as opposed to helping people use it better or easier or more safely, mm-hmm. that's also an issue. You know, mm-hmm. that came up with the segue quite a bit. That was quite an incredible story.
Great example.
Yeah. Dean Kamen, who invented it, had this grandiose vision of making the world a better place environmentally, having people tool around on Segways, on the personal transporters, I think he called them, and instead of in cars. And so he superimposed his vision so much on the company that he had them working on things that were actually adverse to the health of the people who were using them. For example, mm-hmm. early on in that company, there was a really big push to work with municipalities to allow the Segways on sidewalks. And they were successful to a degree to get them allowed on a lot of sidewalks. And then eventually, you know, the emergency room started to see a lot of people who had been on a Segway and had hurt themselves. Mm-hmm. And so their prioritization of clearing the road for the Segway as opposed to actually making sure it was safe first, you know, backfired on them. A lot of customers were not interested in using them or banned them. Disney banned them from their parks. A lot of municipalities actually banned them from the sidewalks. So it backfired on them.
It brought to mind for me certain companies or cultures where things like that might happen. And one of the first things they might think, maybe they don't say it, but is these people are idiots. The customers are idiots. They don't get this.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like, that is not the customer's problem. And the customer is probably not an idiot. And it was very revealing, and I can see it, and I even found it here. It says, a brand's culture can be ruled and distorted by laser focus on growth and the accompanying metrics. Now, you joked about Facebook earlier, but you do talk about that quite a bit in this chapter.
Yeah, I take them to task. Because
give us an example of what you're talking about, because I think a lot of people are very familiar with this.
Right, with Facebook. So, you know, Facebook has had all sorts of data piracy and fake news, and has actually been accused of facilitating the instigation of violence in certain places. And they talk about being, you know, wanting to help their customers get a good experience and that they're not in favor of all of these things. But when you look at their company values, the user is just not there.
Yes, an afterthought, not much more than a data source.
Right, right. And you talked about those organizations that can't imagine that the customer wouldn't love it or wouldn't or that are incentivizing people in a way that leaves the customer out of it. I see that in Facebook's values. I mean, one of theirs is to move fast and break things. And they say in their explanation, because most companies, when they have a value, they have a sort of a little blurb explaining what that means, is they're more afraid of missing out and not being advanced than they are of doing things wrong. And with a brand of Facebook's influence, that is really scary to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, every problem that you present, you then provide even more about how to solve those problems. So there's kind of a theme of my questions here. And in this chapter about self-centered brands, you explain that brand values are what can help you. Again, it's a term that I think people might not fully understand, but could you explain what your definition is of brand values and how they can start to help with becoming less self-centered as a brand?
Yeah. So a minute ago, we talked about brand identity being purpose and attributes, and the purpose is the goal of where you're going, the problem you're solving, and the attributes to define your brand personality. Brand values are essentially a behavioral code. And, you know, when companies are small, they may not see the need for this because maybe the founder isn't in touch with everybody who's working for the company, so they can impart to them how they would like them to behave on behalf of the brands. But if you're growing and you're going to scale and get large, and some of the brands we're talking about are very large, the founder and even the management team can't be present in every interaction to guide people on their behavior. They need some code to let people know how they want them to act on behalf of the brand. And that's the role that brand values serve.
So how do you go about, or what are some of the high-level things that you do to start to tease out those brand values? One that I particularly liked was to run it by your employees or get their feedback, because it's my sense that a lot of times some CEO may say, well, these are the three words that are important to me, and they're on the plaque on my wall. Go value it.
Right. Well, so when your brand team grows, they become a part of your brand and the face of your brand to anybody they're interacting with, which means that they bring their personal values with them too. So if your team has accumulated to be at least, you know, some sort of critical size, you need their input on what's meaningful for them and the ways in which they think the brand should behave. It's not just them. One of the things I talk about later in the book is the brand Spotify. Mm-hmm. And their initial values were spec'd out by Daniel Ek, who's the CEO, at the beginning of the brand. And then when they reasserted their brand leadership, which I don't know if we're going to talk about that or not, but they went through a company-wide brand exercise where they involved all their employees initially and then some representative team for the rest of the time to determine what their values were. And if you look at their original values and the values where they arrived, a lot of the initial values that Daniel Ek spec'd out survived. They're similar. They might be described a little differently. And so that what that says to me is that he was good in bringing in people who subscribed to his values and carried them on. But now everybody in the company has had a little bit more say about how they think Spotify should present itself to the world.
Mm-hmm. And I love how it makes people, it seems like it's working well if the frontline employees understand it and it helps them to make decisions on the spot. I mean, you think of like a concierge or somebody in the hospitality industry, certain brands will be so well-defined that people that are at the desk know how to solve the problem and know the right approach.
And isn't that wonderful when you're the customer sitting there and you don't need it to be bumped up three levels to some manager when that person can just take care of it right there? That's such a good look for a brand.
It is. And I think it's wonderful in part because it's so rare. So, Evelyn, again, let's get back to me, okay? I have a confession to make. I don't know what it is about you, but I just want to share certain things about myself now that you brought me out of my shell, okay? And one thing is I have a confession to make. One of my favorite movies was mentioned in your book, and one of my favorite movies is Mean Girls.
Just want you to know, if you need anything, don't be shy, okay? There are no rules in this house. I'm not like a regular mom. I'm a cool mom.
So, Evelyn, I don't know if you're a cool mom or not. I was not a cool dad. My kids never wanted their friends coming over. But this is the chapter on suffering from fear of missing out and trying too hard to fit in. Again, you know, it's difficult to pick which of the eight we could talk about, but this one I see all the time. So explain why Mean Girls was such a great jumping off point, in my opinion, for the chapter on suffering from fear of missing out and trying too hard to fit in.
So it's a story of a girl who had been homeschooled and is first exposed to a public high school and immediately, almost immediately, starts changing her behavior to get in with the crowd and shed some of a lot of her own personality, her clothing preferences, a lot of her habits, just to be with the way that these queen bees were operating. And so that's what I see in the marketplace with brands. There are a lot of brands who are terrified of not listing every benefit they have that matches their competitors. And you know, when you do that, there's no difference between you. You really struggle to describe why it is they should choose you over the other. So that was the connection.
That is so fetch. Gretchen, stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not going to happen.
Oh, boy. You know, I've really enjoyed getting ready for this interview.
Hey, you guys. Happy hour is from 4 to 6.
Is there alcohol in this?
Oh, God, honey, no. What kind of mother do you think I am? Why, do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
I'm sorry. You made the mistake of talking about one of my favorite movies, and I just wanted to beat it to death. Okay, so trying to be all things to all people can paralyze a brand. Can you share with us an example of it almost brings to mind a restaurant. You don't have this in the book, but a restaurant that has too big a menu where they want to offer everything.
Right. You know, and if they don't do it all well, but they feel like they have to have it because the restaurant next to them has it.
Yes.
You know, they're not doing themselves any favors. But the example that I saw so much earlier in my consultancy was private schools. And this, if you haven't been shopping for a private school, you wouldn't see. But if you go onto the website of any private schools, the litany of things they list: individualized attention, we serve the whole child, you know, I forget what all of them are, but there's just on and on and on these lists they would have. And I would say to them, because I had them as clients early on, you know, but what makes you stand out? Mm-hmm. Oh, we don't want to run with that because then they might think we don't have this. And that, you know, of course you serve the whole child. Of course you give them individualized attention. What are these people paying you thousands of dollars to do? But, you know, that's actually a cost of playing in the industry. It's not a differentiator, and it's not what you lead with because you're not going to get attention that way.
Yeah. So it leads us to the discussion of niches. Okay, talk about, and again, you're very clear. You say, you know, niches take bravery and discipline. I mean, it is hard, but the companies that do it seem to be very successful. It may seem counterintuitive because they don't want to miss out on things, but talk about how a niche can help differentiate your brand and position it for better growth.
So a niche helps get you known. It helps your audience say, oh my gosh, they're for me, or they're speaking to me, or you know, they get exactly what I need. And that's really important early on when your brand is trying to gain traction and increase awareness and be known for competency in something. It's really hard to be good at everything all at once. But if you get a niche and you can focus, then people know you for that thing. You can go long and deep in that industry and really become known for it. And, you know, one of the examples I use in my book, people are always saying to me, well, isn't a niche limiting? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, Amazon was a niche business originally. You know, Jeff Bezos wanted to create an everything store, but he knew he needed to lead with something and become known for something and focus on that. And 3 years in, you know, by the time he started opening up to other categories, on books alone, it was an over $200 million business. So, you know, niches don't have to be limiting.
Yes, yes, they can be a great start. What are some of the things that companies can do to start to find what their niche are? And I should add that I believe that's the section, that chapter, that it's more of a realization of something that makes sense rather than something that comes out of the blue, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, that's exactly it. So, and sometimes you when you start your business, you don't actually know what niche you're going to be in. You know, you get started and you find that you have a strength in a particular area or serving a particular audience. And so by way of a story, you know, one of the brands, the smaller brands that I mentioned in there is called Gluten-Free Territory. And that was started by Barbara Friedman and her daughter Ariel. But when Barbara started her baking business, she wasn't doing gluten-free. She had a business called Barbara's Brownies, and she was serving local restaurants in the New Hampshire area, one in particular called the Flatbread Company. And one day, she goes in to deliver her brownies, and she sees this table of a large family where everyone, the parents and all the children but one, are enjoying dessert. And she sees that kid looking miserable and learns that that child is gluten-free and can't enjoy dessert. And it was like a light bulb moment to her. So she kept on producing her regular products and started trying to formulate a gluten-free brownie because this so disturbed her. And, you know, come to find out as they investigated the industry that there were very few gluten-free products that had a good mouthfeel and a good taste. And so when they figured it out and got that recipe going, you know, it was a huge differentiator for them. And then they started producing round brownies also so that restaurants and other places couldn't mix up the ones that were gluten-free with the regular ones. And their business just took off. And so she shifted. This is several years into business. All of their marketing and their resources in terms of growing the business to the Gluten-Free Territory, which is what they named that brand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes you discover your strength partway in, and other times, you know, it's out of the box.
Yes. And you write that if your brand is going to stand for something, it's going to have to say no to some things. And I couldn't agree more. And it also brought to mind a book by Rebecca Geyer that was on the show. She wrote Smart Marketing for Engineers, and she says, you have to say no to grow. And again, it seems so counterintuitive, but it's great advice. And if I could just mention one other book that goes really into depth on this, it was on the show a couple years back, was by David C. Baker called The Business of Expertise. And it's a real deep dive into helping companies, you know, a little bit more in this area. So anyway, I don't know. I learned a lot.
I'm kind of psychic. I have a fifth sense. What do you mean? It's like I have ESPN or something.
So I include that to wrap up this section on Mean Girls and, you know, fear of missing out, trying to fit in. Because truly the whole movie was a nightmare of someone trying to be something that they weren't. But yeah. Let's go to the last one here. It has to do with oversleeping, which I don't know if I should laugh or cry because having raised teenagers – every one of these came to mind, so they really resonated with me. But again, this one, I got a lot out of. And before we get into it, what are some of the signs that your brand is oversleeping? And I guess the thing that surprised me is that so many companies don't realize they're oversleeping.
Well, that's true. But, you know, if they realized it, they would be awake, right?
There you go. Yeah. Like I said, I have ESPN or something. But
right. Exactly.
No,
exactly.
But it was it's such a good example. And I particularly like the solution you have. We'll talk about it in a second here. But what some of the examples that a brand is oversleeping, and you did a brilliant job of explaining the blockbuster phenomenon. And I have read about them in other books. And, you know, it's now kind of easy to talk about Blockbuster or Kodak or some of these companies that were just, you know, it was really difficult for them to transition. I didn't realize that Blockbuster almost came back.
Yeah.
And then they kind of snatched a loss from the jaws of victory.
Exactly. And if the board of Blockbuster hadn't stopped that CEO, who was John Antioco, from, you know, countering Netflix, you know, all of our lives during the pandemic could have been very different. We might not have had Netflix to watch. Mm-hmm. So, but you asked me about the signs of oversleeping and how you would know. So I want to get back and answer that question. You know, if your customer base has been slowly slipping away, you know, maybe not big drops, but a little bit of shrinkage there. If you've been blindsided by a competitor's move or new product, that's a sign. If you're behind the eight ball, sort of trying to put together something that's trend relevant, you know, like you know, a lot of brands who are like, maybe Clubhouse is a good idea. I don't know.
Check the box marketing, right?
Right. If you've, you know, if you discovered that some of your customers are buying some of their solution from your competitors to fill in gaps that you have, that's also a sign that you may be oversleeping. And if you're technologically behind, you know, if your website is taking 10 seconds to load, forget it, people. You know, you need to remedy that fast. So those are a few, not all of them, but a few of the signs that you may not be paying attention to the needs of your customers and what they're looking for, not only in the outcome from your brand, but in the experience from your brand.
So the solution, well, not the solution, but the way to start to nip this in the bud is by developing a strategic plan. And that's just one of my favorite topics. And could you talk a bit about that, and this doesn't mean a high-priced you know, consultant that has to come in to get you started. Talk about the strategic plan, because, you know, when I've done some of these things on a rudimentary level that you talk about over the years, it's like it completely changes the conversation and it gets people thinking. I love it. Talk a bit about doing a strategic plan.
Well, you know, as a consultant, both of us, or as an agency, the number one thing that we need to do when we come into a job is understand the brand, because we're coming from a place of much less knowledge. So we tend to have a phase that's, start off with an sort of an assessment of what's going on and understanding of a position. A lot of people inside companies never do that for themselves. And so this is why I'm sure it changes the conversation for you, because you're looking at things that people inside the company don't think to look at.
Yes.
And it's eye-opening, you know, reading your reviews, looking at your competitors' reviews, you know, watching the news, even just putting out alerts and reading about what's going on, watching the trends in the industries, and particularly the trends that your customers are taking advantage of. Mm-hmm. You need to be in touch with them and watching so that you can see change coming as opposed to getting blindsided by it.
Yes. And, you know, in the agency world, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was to become experts on your clients' or your prospects' customers. It just, not many people do that. And it really quiets the clients down. In other words, like I've mentioned in this show not too long ago, I can remember at one point we were doing work for this one client and it was a personal injury law firm. And, you know, they're on television a lot. And we were stopping people on the street and asking them some simple questions on camera about, you know, lawyers in town and so forth. And it was so revealing. And it was the one time those lawyers sat quietly for 45 minutes watching this video of people. They were so, Yeah, they, like so many of us, they were so close to the too close to their own business. And I, you know, you talk about doing a SWOT analysis and doing it correctly, how to frame that out, and you know, looking at your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And it does seem like it's easier when I've been on the outside of an organization to be able to do this. That's why I think it's helpful to have somebody from the outside come in and do it.
Sometimes it is easier to partner with somebody from the outside because they're going to look under rocks that you don't want to disturb. You know,
yeah.
It's you don't know what you don't know. And if you haven't been looking for a while, the fear of being surprised is, you know, a deterrent to you actually finding out. So, but you don't wake an oversleeping brand by taking an ostrich approach.
Yes. And another part, you talk about developing a plan. And folks, this is only one chapter, okay? So it's not like you're having to read a 400-page book about the strategic plan. But you write, and I think very wisely, say you're not a fan of making detailed plans for more than a year or two at a time. Why do you say that?
Because things change so fast. You know, when you make a five-year plan, unless you have some sort of initiative that's going to require that kind of time frame, that's sort of a separate thing. But when you make plans for more than a year or two, you know, the chance that you're not going to revisit that and be in touch with what's going on goes way up. The size of the plan increases. The likelihood that it's going to sit on a shelf and look pretty also increases. When you have something that is lean and mean that you can, you know, put on a page and put on your wall in front of your desk, then that's really going to serve you well and it's going to be actionable.
Yes, sort of like those brand values where a frontline employee understands and they're able to make decisions on it. And also, you talked about awakening a sleeping brand. There was one of many lines in the book that really spoke to me when you said, not all prospects are interested in the change that solving the problem might involve. Mm. You've probably had clients over the years that think if they can write a check, the problem's going to go away. It's right. Not something that, I mean, a lot of the book, you're talking about things that are at a strategic level and they involve leadership of a company. So, I mean, as much as we would like to be able to say, yep, we can solve all your problems, well, we can't. And we kind of know how these things, how they end. So, Evelyn, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Having a clearly defined brand is crucial for growth and success. I can't say it any more directly than that. Without that definition, it's impossible to market consistently, to align everyone on the brand team, to focus on the customer's desired outcomes, and to deliver a good experience.
And that is made even stronger by all the examples you have of companies that struggled with their brands and then finally figured it out. So again, this was not a book about logos and you know, arts and crafts party planning. So well said. What's one thing a listener could do today to get them headed in the right direction based on one of the many ideas in your book or that perhaps we've talked about?
So I think that right now, anyone listening should put together an email to a few dozen of their customers, colleagues, employees, and friends and ask them, what are the first three or four words or phrases that come to mind when you think of my brand? You know, and if the listener happens to be a solo professional, that's going to work for their company too. But you can get personal brand input or company brand input really quickly in a sort of quick and dirty way by asking, you know, 45, 50 people. Maybe you get 20 responses, and then you tally their responses and see what three or four words rise to the top. And those are likely your brand attributes.
Yes. And in that identity crisis section, you even had some scripts, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
I wrote the email for you. You just have to copy it out of the book and send it out.
Yes, that's right. You wrote the email of what you could send to your customers, and I loved how you did that. It was almost that's great advice. Get that in the from the book and send those emails, and you're gonna be surprised, but you might very likely like what you hear from your customers.
Well, and then I will say that, you know, for anybody who's like, geez, I'm not sure I want to hear this, let me just say that generally people respond very positively. You know, this could be a love fest for you. So it's not something you necessarily need to be afraid of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then there was another book years ago. Sorry, they all start to blur together. You know, all the books, all the wine. I'm sure you understand. But it was talking about how most customers like you more than you might realize. And you just, like you said, you might even start a bit of a love fest there. So, Evelyn, what books have most inspired your work and career?
Well, now that you know that I was female class bookworm in high school, I have to say, as an avid reader, when I considered this question, I had to stop myself at five. But I have five to mention quickly.
Well, I have plenty of audio tape, so just go crazy. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. The first two books are by Seth Godin, Purple Cow and The Dip.
Uh-huh.
Purple Cow, because it really called out, it really challenged people to assess something that is truly remarkable, not something you'd like to think of as remarkable. And The
well,
Dip.
Well, also, you're all about purple.
That's true. That is very true. You know, I actually, that was probably a big part of it. Who knows? And then The Dip is so great to explain that, you know, when you're in a long endeavor and you're working towards something, there's going to be that middle part that's less sexy, that's less exciting, and you got to slog through it. So I found that very inspirational. Another book I love is Made to Stick by Dan and Chip Heath.
Oh, yeah. Those guys are such great authors.
They are. They really are. And their, you know, formula for and guidance on how to explain an idea so that it's memorable and that people actually get a clear idea of what you're talking about was just so easy to follow.
Yes, absolutely. What else?
The fourth book is The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz, which was not only helpful from a marketing point of view, but also from a personal sanity point of view, because he talks in the beginning about how exhausting making choice after choice after choice in our lives when we have too many things to choose from actually is. You know?
Yes.
And that changed my life, that book.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and that's been mentioned by some other authors as well. Very popular book.
And the last book I want to share is called Finish by John A. Cuff. The thing I liked about Finish is that he did research among some very successful people. And what he found is they're not necessarily working harder or longer. They have more realistic expectations of what they can achieve. People are notoriously bad for estimating how much time things will take them. And so one of the pieces of advice from that book is, you know, cut your expectation or cut your goal in half, either double the time or half the goal. And what that does is it doesn't make you less successful. It just sets you up for failure a lot less. You feel much better about it. So that was really helpful.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that one. Finish. Give yourself the gift of done.
Mm.
Oh, terrific. Thanks for mentioning that. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading now that you've finished your book?
Well, you know, as a bookworm, I rarely wait too long before I find out a book and dive in. So there are two books that were published this year that I've really enjoyed. Humor Seriously by Jennifer Aker and Naomi Bagdonas.
Oh, yeah.
Was terrific. Really, and immediately helpful to me in my marketing and in my writing because they don't spend a ton of time, but they do explain the science and importance of using humor both in work and life. And then they have all these great tips and tricks to help you look for opportunities for levity. And that it was very encouraging. You know, you don't have to be a successful stand-up to implement this stuff.
Yeah, I think I would like that. I've interviewed Jennifer's father, David Ocker, twice. And I actually wrote her and invited her on, and it was before the pandemic. And I think they moved the release of the book back. But I'll have to follow up and see if I might be able to get her to come on the show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you'd love the book. Douglas. And then the last one, which I'm partial to, is Cumulative Advantage. And I'm a little biased there because I got to see that in the making. But what I really love about Mark Schaefer's latest book is the idea that anybody who comes upon an idea that has legs can make it work. And I also like the concept he talks about, you know, helping people coming up behind you and reaching out to people who are ahead of you for help.
Yes, and I enjoyed reading about you in that book, along with our other friend, John Asperian. It's like we're all Mark's children, you know? Mm. I'm kidding. But yeah, that was terrific. And there's always something so new and original in his books. And part of it is because I think that he doesn't write a book until he's tormented by something.
Yeah.
He can't figure something out. And then he pours his heart and soul into it. And that's why he's the king of the marketing book podcast. So, you know, well, that's great. That's great. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books you mentioned and your website and your LinkedIn profile. And for you, dear listener, please do me a big, big favor and reach out to Evelyn. Reach out to her on LinkedIn or Twitter or email her or go to her website. I'm going to have a link to it. Sign up for her newsletter. But please thank her for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. There are over 1 million podcasts out there, and she has spent a lot of time with us, and she's worked on this book for, somebody says, oh, it took a year to write a book. No, it didn't. It's your whole career you've been writing a book. And so authors who've been on the show just love hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners. It really makes their day. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The book is Teenage Waste Brand, How Your Brand Can Stop Struggling and Start Scaling. The author is Evelyn Starr. Evelyn, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.